Welcome to the LaCoolCast Volume 2, the final episode in our two-part Offset special.
Simon here. Coming up in this episode, we'll be looking back at what was no doubt an infectiously exciting Offset festival. The setting was spectacular and the mood was upbeat, and for once, everyone seemed to park their economic worries at the door. In this podcast, we'll be hearing from the original ad man, legendary art director and iconic image maker, George Lois.
When you look at a design, if you don't get it in a nanosecond, to me it's a piece of shit.
Illustrator Nate Williams will offer some insights into the peculiarities of cultural differences.
I speak horrible Spanish, I'm colorblind, and I'm dyslexic. And I was giving a talk on, you know, illustration and hand lettering in Spanish. And it just kind of struck me as like, it's really weird that I'm here.
Designer Scott Burnett tells us about his plans for a Greater Dublin.
It's all about innovation, it's all about ideas. There's so much learning for business here, but there's nobody from IDA.
But first, editorial designer James Kelleher talks to Scott Dadich, creative director of Wired magazine and Condé Nast's digital savior, about readers, money, and how the iPad offers a new frontier for publishers and designers.
Your career arc has been somewhat accelerated. You've gone from Texas Monthly to art director of Texas Monthly in a very short space of time, to Wired, then on to head up to become digital overlord of Condé Nast. Have you had lunch over the past 15 years at all?
A little bit. It's been fun, but I started at a pretty early age. I was working while I was still in school, so I was able to dip into it pretty early on. So when I was 18, I was actually working as a designer and art director at Texas Tech, working for a really great photographer and a friend of mine. So I got to get a head start on things, so that helped out a bit.
Okay. There was a time there, not so long ago, with Wired, when you seemed to be making all the right moves. The team did, anyway. You were winning awards left, right, and center. Circulation was up, but ad revenue was down. Mm. And now that's been reversed. So a lot of your decisions that you made during that time have been vindicated. But at that time, was it a very frustrating time for you?
Well, we knew it wasn't anything that was having to do with the relationship of our work, that in fact the relationship between our readers and the magazine had never been stronger. It's still continuing to grow. Our renewals are up, newsstand sales were up, so people were connecting with the magazine, and the relationship across the company that was true with a lot of the brands, or most of the brands at the Condé Nast. But clearly what was different was the recession took its toll in terms of ad pages and the money that advertisers and agencies were spending on ad pages. So that was definitely frustrating, and certainly part of a larger problem where the publishing industry was propped up by ad dollars rather than the consumer relationship. And we weren't paying... consumers and readers weren't paying the full value of the magazine. So when you buy a magazine on the newsstand for $5, that's sort of more akin to what the cost value of it is in terms of manufacturing and the photography. And if you were going to pay for a subscription based on the money that we put into it, you know, you'd be paying several orders of magnitude more than the $10 we charge. So that $10 a month was sort of, you know, just to capture and monetize and demonstrate to advertisers that our value, there's content, there's value to our content. Mm-hmm. And that's really what that relationship was about. So what we really have needed to do in the past few years is change how people perceive the value of our magazines and getting them to pay more for the subscription. But the problem is that people have gotten used to that $10 a month situation, mm-hmm. or $10 a year situation, rather.
The iPad obviously has, it appeals to publishers in that it's a walled garden, in a sense, mm-hmm. but it's a paywall that doesn't seem like a paywall. Mm-hmm. And you share some of the objectives with your publisher with regards to the iPad, but exclusively as a designer, what appeals to you about the format particularly?
One is the engagement, the fact that we can put high fidelity designs together and package them in a cohesive bundle, if you'll forgive the word, and relate directly to readers all across the world. That in the past we've had the physical limitations of getting the paper out and mailing it and post and shipping all over the country, let alone to other countries. And the iPad lets us relate to and connect with our readers no matter where they are, and do it instantaneously with no shipping and none of the sort of destructive elements of printing and paper and the carbon that's involved with that. So that on a basic level is really appealing to me, but also the sort of richness of that engagement, the beauty of the screen and the colors and the ability to connect high quality, well-crafted design with a variety of different experiences and people and app engagements or magazine or print or whatever you want to call it, in ways that people typically haven't been able to access.
You're very heavily invested in the iPad now. And Condé Nast have thrown a lot of resources behind it. But do you think that if large publishers had jumped as enthusiastically onto the web feet first, then maybe we'd be looking at a very different landscape now?
That's a good question. I think there are a lot of parallels, actually, because Wired covered a lot of the troubles and sort of great opportunities that the web presented in the early 90s. And certainly a lot of the opportunities present themselves here, and a lot of the dangers also present themselves with monopoly and that walled garden aspect and the sort of restrictions of accessing that content. I think the bottom line is it's just too early to tell. Mm-hmm. And we just don't know how this is going to shake out and really what the emergent model is going to be. I think most publishers, and Condé included, see this as an opportunity to recalibrate that relationship with our readers. Hopefully this is a point that we can recalibrate people's expectations around paying for content, and that there is value in it. And when you think about a TV show that you download from iTunes, or a movie, and the, you know, whether it's an episode of The Office that's 22 minutes and you're paying $2 for that, or an episode of Lost that's 44 minutes, or a feature film at 90 minutes, the price around those is pretty much what you're getting from a magazine, and you're getting actually similar or greater levels of engagement and time investment. You know, something like The New Yorker that you can sit down and there's 2 hours of reading in there, and hopefully we've introduced you to a new point of view or a piece of news, an analysis about news that maybe you wouldn't have gained just sort of casually browsing the web.
The rewards of editorial design are very tangible for somebody in your position. You get to hang out with Brad Pitt, for example, right? You have a lot of resources at your disposal. But not everybody is going to be the art director of Wired. Could you explain to a recent graduate the appeal of editorial design, exclusive from the Brad Pitt?
Well, I can speak from experience of having very few or no resources at Texas Monthly and getting to do very similar kinds of work. Having the right ideas grants access to resources and people and opportunities. And it's really about the power of the creative and the power of the message that you're trying to craft.
During the festival, Michael from Lacool spoke to a number of those attending. Here's a taste of what they had to say.
My name is Jason Brooke. I'm an illustrator, and primarily I do storyboard work for the film industry. I've just been working in the art department as well on the Camelot production, shooting an artwork. It's been pretty good just to, learn from, you know, industry names, and to learn how they approach their craft and where they've come from and how they've arrived at where they are at the moment in terms of their style and the success that they've achieved.
Hi, my name is Bridget Butler. I'm a student from the Limerick School of Art and Design. So I was here last year at it, and like, it was a great event. So this year a lot more people came from the college as well. Hugely helpful, hugely beneficial. Last year, I think the greatest thing was that, you know, we saw designers as real people, because usually you just see their work, you don't see any of the work behind it or them. Now it's like you see them as real people, you realise they've made fuck-ups too, they haven't just made great work all their life or something, you know. With the talks going on in the second room, you know, there was Scott from our AAD yesterday, he gave a talk about what they're involved in, other designers, and they all have fingers in something else. Like, you know, it's not, it seems to be that's the way things are going now. You can't just be stuck in one, doing one thing, you have to be involved in much more, you have to get out there. Like. And there was an internship talk then today as well, which was very helpful, you know, in so far as what you should be doing, what you should have in your portfolio, that kind of thing.
Next up, we hear from Nate Williams, the founder of the illustration community website, Illustration Mundo.
About 7 years ago, I had a kind of a premature midlife crisis. So I did the logical thing and I sold my house, I quit my job, and I moved to Latin America. It's really interesting because I think living in another country is probably one of the most valuable experiences that I've had. And you really, really understand that you can't just look at a culture. You really have to be in it to understand how it works, you know? So one example, in Latin America, when I got there, I'd be in a taxi. I'd have this really, like, intellectual conversation with a taxi driver. And then there would be, like, a gorgeous lady. And he'd stop and honk and whistle at her. And then he'd go back to talking to me about what we were talking about. And when I first got there, I was like, that's really sexist, you know? But also, I think it's just a different appreciation. And you also have to think, in Latin America, you know, the president of Chile is a woman, the president of Argentina is a woman. And so you just have to view it differently. You have to be more open-minded, and before you say anything, just kind of, you know, relax and try to figure out why. When I very first got there, I stayed with a host family, but, you know, I probably spoke about 3 words of Spanish, and he didn't speak any English. So, I mean, I could just tell that they were really good people, and made me feel really welcome. And then that night, he actually came to my room, and he said, ¿Puedo molestarte? In Spanish, which just means, you know, can I bother you for a second? But with my limited Spanish, I just heard the word molestar, which sounds a lot like the word molest. So I was like, okay, this is going to be interesting. But he didn't want to molest me. He basically just wanted to invite me to dinner. And in Argentina, it's a really, there's a huge culture around asado, which is how you cook beef. So basically, he wanted to invite me to have some meat with him. And he wanted to make me feel at home. So he had a little electronic translator, and he looked up the word meat. And it gave a few different options. And I guess the top option was flesh. So the very first thing, you know, I heard blah, 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 molest. Would you like some flesh? And, you know, but anyway, we got that sorted out. When I worked at Microsoft, I felt like everything was too strategic. When I did my own stuff, I felt like I had no reason for anything. And that was kind of a response. I had to respond really strongly. But actually, I really do value good concepts. And I also value no concepts. I really like concepts for editorial work, where I also think that no concepts is great for environmental. It's more about how you feel, you know? And it's just creating a feeling rather than, you know, it's kind of like a sunset. You don't look at a sunset and say, what does it mean? You're just like, that's nice. And that's what a lot of illustration does. It's just to kind of create a feeling. And then also, I'm dyslexic. So, and they actually discovered that I had dyslexia when I was doing math, because I would do the same math problem twice, and then I'd skip one. And they realized that my eyes were just all over the map. So basically, I think that I really appreciate type, because I didn't really see it as hello, or I didn't see it as cat. I just saw it as like, whoa, a curve, and you know, and that's kind of how I viewed it. And I think that your brain does a lot. Your brain really helps you see. Like, I really think our eyes are not that great, and our brain makes up a lot of information. And I think when our brain's making up that information, that's where a lot of creativity comes up for, you know? It's like, if you have a question, you think of all these possibilities. Maybe it's this, maybe it's that, maybe it's that. And a lot of times you're wrong, but you're like, wow, that's a pretty cool idea, you know? And you have something. And actually, like, in a moment just like now, I realized how funny it was, because I speak horrible Spanish, I'm colorblind, and I'm dyslexic. And I was giving a talk on, you know, illustration and hand lettering in Spanish. And it just kind of struck me as like, it's really weird that I'm here. My dyslexia is still very present. If you ever get an email from me, it kind of looks like Morse code. But it's, you know, it's a lot better. I have great reading comprehension now. Some of the best ways to come up with great ideas is to have experiences. It's like, a lot of times when you create illustrations, you basically draw from your experiences and you make analogies. And the more experiences and analogies you have to draw from, you know, you're going to have this bigger world. Thank you.
And that was Nate Williams. Coming up in a bit, George Lois.
Mad Men misrepresents the advertising industry by ignoring the dynamics of the creative evolution that changed the world of communications forever. That mortal sin of omission makes madmen a lie.
But first, Michael from The Cool talks to Scott Burnett as he unveils his new project.
A Greater Dublin.
A Greater Dublin, yeah. New initiative project, I don't know what you call it, that I've started with Johnny Boyle, that we've been kicking around for a few years. I guess the seed of it all was that we, you know, we were chatting about the Monocle City Living Index, and Dublin's nowhere to be seen, and which we can understand why, but the question arose, how, what would it take to change that? What would it take? What does Dublin need to make it one of those, you know, amazing cosmopolitan European cities that people love? And I guess that a website is the simplest, cheapest way to kind of maybe start looking at it. So it's a quite a simple idea. There's three areas in the website. One is a kind of news feed of great ideas that are happening internationally in cities. One is an area where we're going to champion people that we feel already kind of go out of their way and to do things for cities, for Dublin, and kind of try to raise the bar from it'll be grand to it'll be something better. And we're basically going to ask those people, we're going to curate and ask those people to basically present a proposal for a Greater Dublin. It can be a small detail or a massive idea. But it's 5 to 10 slides, so it's not a big task that we're asking people to do. And then the last part is going to be an ongoing Google map that we're just going to populate with past and present, you know, the things that make Dublin a great place rather than just a grand place. So
it's a curated site, obviously, in terms of what content goes in.
Yeah, especially with the news, we're going to be kind of always actively looking for news about ideas from different cities, but we're asking people to kind of feed in anything that they think is relevant. The map, again, same thing. I guess we are the editors of that map. But again, we're going to be taking it on to Twitter and asking people to kind of suggest the places. We don't want to be the only people, because I'm sure there's stuff we don't know about. And then the proposal part is much more of a curated place. And the reason for that is there's a lot of crowdsourcing going about. There's a lot of different projects around the city, and that's all great. But what we want to champion, what we're really interested in, are the people we feel that actually go out of their way to try and do what we're talking about already. And we want to give them a place to say, well, what would you do with the city? Because Dublin City Council isn't asking these people when it should be.
And how significant is something like Offset and your observations from this weekend being down here, the people that are here, the people that aren't here?
Yeah, hugely. I think Offset is amazing. Started by three people that just did it off their own back. The size of this, 1,200 people, 3D event, it's all about innovation, it's all about ideas. There's so much learning for business here, but there's nobody from IDA, you know, there's nobody from Dublin City Council made it down. Cultural tourism is apparently very high on the agenda within Tourism Ireland. You know, this is a perfect case in point. This is the pinnacle of cultural tourism. And that's a perfect example. You know, the kind of discussions and debates that have been going on here are about innovation, which we're told is apparently what Ireland is great at the moment. But the people who are selling it don't know anything about this. So I think that's the kind of disconnect that really needs to be addressed, because this should be a kind of jewel in the crown of Innovation Ireland. It should be championed. And again, it's kind of willfully neglected. And the world, it needs to change, you know, otherwise Ireland won't be innovative.
Here's some more thoughts from those attendees.
My name's Jennifer Farley, and I'm a designer and an illustrator. I have a very small little company called Laughing Line Design, and I'm here really for inspiration, of which I'm getting loads. It's been really good. Well, I mean, I love Nate Williams. I really like Gary Baseman. It's just completely insane and very interesting to listen to, and also to meet people. I work by myself a lot and can feel very isolated. So just coming here today, you know, you get to meet a few people and make a couple of connections. So it's good. It's good that way. That's probably the best thing about this is that there's a lot of people who are working alone, and then they come to this and they, you know, they can see, well, there's actually an awful lot going on.
Pedro Ribeiro. I loved the conferences. And Offset, I think, is very, very, very important to the graphic designers, to report experiences and enjoy. I want to see everything, but Scott Davis with the evolution to the graphic design and the internet.
Just before we hear from Mr. Lois, here's Carl from Synth Eastwood telling us about their latest project.
We have a hippo here built today, built by the architects ABGC, very kindly for them. It's an amazing looking thing. And what we're doing is experiments. It's a show called Lost in Translation. So the idea is we're starting off at a starting point, like a visual piece of work, and getting X amount of people, say 20, 30, to describe the next one. It's not Chinese whispers, but the starting piece of artwork is obviously going to be changed by all the descriptions. And then we get the last ones to redraw it. So we compare the two and how much they've changed. So there's variations. There's maybe four different variations of that. So some of them we're using, some of the speakers here, we're using their artwork as a starting piece, and which they don't know. And they're the last person in the chain to draw. So they don't realise they're actually drawing their own piece of artwork, which is nice.
So they're being invited back in.
Yeah, and they've no idea it's their own.
And are they told at the end?
Yeah, we will tell them.
Okay.
And then we're going to try other ones, maybe portrait. So we might come in and take a picture of someone and I get someone else to draw that as best they can, and so on and so on. So we'll be able to give someone a portrait of themselves that's been done by 30 people, kind of thing. Might frame it up or something nicely. So it's, I guess it's all about, it's like Chinese whispers, but yep, just about how people describe visual work. So...
And great. Just in terms of offset, how important it is coming back to this? Because you're based
amazing.
In London. Yeah.
Yeah, amazing. It's you're kind of killing so many birds with one stone. You come back and just meeting everybody, and just the best of all the industries as well, and great place to exchange ideas and meet more people. And it's just encouraging. People are still doing stuff even though there's such a recession. Yeah. I mean, even this is flying. Offset's flying in the face of it, which is, yeah. I mean, this place, everything. It's just has to be positive, you know.
Yeah.
So that's really important.
If you'd like to know more about that hippo, have a look at syntheastwood.com. Okay, George Lois believes that creativity can solve anything. As art director, he revolutionized the whole industry. As a designer, he made empires for clients. And then, of course, there is his iconic cover art for Esquire magazine. Here he lays down his golden rules and why he hates being called the original madman.
Great to be here, it really is. I come from a country where, unfortunately, they have been calling me for the last 3 or 4 years the original madman, which is infuriating. But we'll talk about that later, because I happen to think it's an insult to the creative revolution in the 60s in America. I figured I really want to talk to you about what I think design means. Unfortunately, I don't think many designers understand what design's supposed to mean. Personally, I have never regarded myself as a designer. I am a graphic communicator because I create big ideas. Surely, great graphic design is not merely the aesthetic arrangement of lines and shapes. Great graphic design is the transformation of a big idea into an unforgettable image. You got that? That's what design is. Design isn't fucking around with lines and blocks and shape. In this astounding new world of technology, all the tools in the world are meaningless without an essential idea. An artist or advertising person, a doctor, a lawyer, an electrician, a factory worker, or a president without an idea is unarmed. When you look at a design, if you don't get it in a nanosecond, to me it's a piece of shit. It ain't design. I mean, it ain't what I think design is. In a profession that should have no rules, I have three commandments, three, for all to heed. One, reject group grope. Learn how to use your own head And don't listen to the bullshitters all around you and the naysayers. Two, reject analysis paralysis. And three, to truly produce masterful work, reject con, create icon. And that's, if you can understand, if you can really understand what I just said, you're going to be a great graphic designer. And if you don't understand what I just said, you're always going to be a designer. I talked about, I said before that I'm in the States and everywhere I go, actually, people call me the original madman. And I guess you get the show here, and everybody here thinks it's wonderful, too. Last month, Playboy magazine asked me if I would like to write something about the Mad Men show. So I think I'm going to read that to you. Then I'm going to go and show you some of the work. The buzz in town was that a great TV series was about to premiere dealing with the ad game in the 1960s, which to me, and those savvy about watershed advertising and media events in American culture, meant only one thing. A popular television series dealing with the explosive triggering of the legendary creative revolution was about to be born. In the 1960s, the dynamic impact of ethnic, passionate, and supremely talented graphic designers and copywriters had turned the ad world upside down, commanding the attention of America and the world with bright, witty, entertaining advertising. The creative revolution exposed the traditional advertising world for what it was, WASP-driven, hackneyed, untalented, simply put, hacks. The news of the Mad Men series was exhilarating to all of us who had played prominent roles in that watershed event. But I wondered, how could they do the period justice without contacting me, the original Mad Men, for input, to consult, or whatever? And then out of the blue, a Mad Men producer called me and told me that they were tracking down some real Mad Men and a few Mad Women to film some promos for the show. And every old timer they contacted blurted out something like, you gotta get George Lois. He was the catalyst who dominated the 60s. Whoa, I said to the clueless Mad Men caller. You mean you guys are doing a TV series based on advertising in the 60s and you never heard of me? No, no, he protested. We know who you are. Bullshit, I said. I told him that if he really wanted to know what happened in the 60s, he should read my biographical book, George, Be Careful. It's a blow-by-blow account of how I triggered the creative fucking revolution that changed the world and hung up plenty miffed. The stunt producer called back a week later and with bated breath said, wow, we could have done a TV show just based on your book. That scene when you hung out a window and threatened to jump if the client didn't buy your matzo poster was hilarious. I told him to kiss my ethnic Greek ass and hung up. Mad Men misrepresents the advertising industry by ignoring the dynamics of the creative revolution that changed the world of communications forever. That mortal sin of omission makes Mad Men a lie. Matthew Weiner, the creative and showrunner of Mad Men, rejects my feelings about his show by stating that George Lois is a legend, but Sterling Cooper is not cutting edge. It's mired in the past, calling his characters dinosaurs. Huh? Therein lies the rub. In creating a popular TV show based on an ad agency, the producers went whole hog to depict the scum of the industry, rather than the upbeat world of culture-busting creativity. Mad Men has given the world the perception that the scatology of the Sterling Cooper workplace was industry-wide. In their advertising, in fact, they have the balls to proclaim that Mad Men explores the golden age of advertising. But they surely know they're shoveling shit. Their show is nothing more than a soap opera placed in a setting of a glamorous office where stylish fools hump their appreciative, coiffured secretaries, suck up martinis, and smoke themselves to death as they produce dumb, lifeless advertising, oblivious to the inspiring civil rights movement at the time, the burgeoning women's movement, the evil Vietnam War, and other seismic changes during the turbulent roller coaster 1960s that altered America forever. In the after hours, when the Sterling Cooper Stiffs were screwing their staff, we athletes at Papakang Lois were playing ball on the best amateur and basketball teams in New York City history, to each his own. So the more I think and write about Mad Men, the more I take the show as a personal insult. So fuck you, Mad Men. You phony, gray flannel suit, male chauvinist, no talent, wasp, white-shirted, racist, anti-Semitic, Republican sons of bitches. Besides, when I was in my 30s, I was better looking than John Hamm.
Coolcast has been brought to you by Kieran, Michael, and Simon, with special thanks to James Kelleher and to Richard, Peter, and Brent from Offset. All support and feedback is welcome. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Claudia Rodriguez.